afternoon. This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:03 p.m. on Thursday, March 28th in Capitol Room 102. Members present are Representatives Klayman, Drummond, Tarr, and myself. Co-Chair Zolkowski and Jackson, Representative Jackson, have been excused from committee business today. Let's see. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to do business. If you could take a moment to silence your phones if you're in the room and haven't already done so, that'd be wonderful. Before we begin, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House Hess Recording Secretary, and Nate Williams from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have a full agenda this afternoon. First up, we'll hear a presentation from the Children's Justice Act Task Force. They're all queued up here already. Second will be a recap of House Bill 22 by Representative Tarr, extending the Suicide Prevention Council. Third, we'll hear a recap of House Bill 29, which is my bill relating to insurance coverage for telehealth appointments. And then we'll hear a recap of HB 97 by Representative Christ Tompkins, covering laws related to telehealth appointments with physician's assistants. Welcome, Representative Pruitt. Finally, we will hear an introduction of HB 86 by Representative Fields, covering contracts and bids relating to mental health hospitals. So now we will turn our attention to our first item, which is a presentation from the Children's Justice Act Task Force. Will you please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Kathy Baldwin Johnson. I'm a physician and the medical director for the Alaska CARES, which is the Child Advocacy Center in Anchorage, and also the Children's Place, which is the Child Advocacy Center in Wasilla.
I'm Dr. Jared Parrish. I'm the senior maternal child health epidemiologist in the Alaska Division of Public Health.
And I'm Mike Hopper, a child adolescent psychologist from Fairbanks.
An all-star lineup this afternoon. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
And I also just want to acknowledge our task force, because we do have a number of members of our task force in the audience. If you guys could please stand real quickly. Thank you.
Thank you for your service, everyone.
All right, so just really briefly, the CJA task force is actually federally mandated and federally funded. Our mission is to identify areas where improvement is needed in the statewide response to child maltreatment, especially child sexual abuse, and make recommendations and then take actions to improve the system. We have a statewide multidisciplinary membership. Some of the past things that we've been involved with have included helping to write legislation that helps to improve protection and justice for children. So, for example, laws to help protect children from being not having enough food and water in their homes, children who've sustained serious physical abuse, and also helping to maintain privacy of children that are seen at child advocacy centers so that their forensic interviews and exams and exam photos don't get widely distributed. A lot of our focus has really been on education about what's going on with child abuse in Alaska, providing training about mandatory reporting, and providing training about best practices for the multidisciplinary response to child abuse. We do have an online training that's free and open to the public, and people can actually get certificates to show that they've completed that training, and it's being widely used by for licensing for daycares around the state right now. Today, what we wanted to talk about is bring you up to date on what's happening with child abuse in Alaska, emphasize the fact that unfortunately it is really common, talk about some of that impact through information with the Adverse Childhood Experiences studies, as well as some of the Alaska ACEs studies, what that's costing our state, what we can do to change that trajectory for our children, with an emphasis that there really is hope for the future, I think. And then we'll end with Dr. Hopper providing kind of a real-life look at what at his experiences seeing people who have sustained significant trauma. So for those people that may not be familiar with the Adverse Childhood Experiences studies, this was a huge collaborative study between the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente, which is a health maintenance organization in California. In this study, there were over 17,000 participants, and they were the kind of people we would usually think of as being pretty low risk for having sustained a lot of bad things in childhood. They were mostly Caucasian. They were mostly middle-aged. They were most of them had at least some college education. They were asked about things that may have happened to them when before they turned the age of 18, and that included different kinds of abuse, including physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, as well as being physically and emotionally neglected. And then there were also 5 questions about family dysfunction. So was there a parent or caregiver in the home that suffered from mental illness? Did somebody in the family go to jail or prison? Did they see their mother being treated violently? Was there substance abuse in the home? Or did they lose a parent through divorce or separation? And one of the things that was really surprising to them was how common this history of child maltreatment was. The other thing that was really surprising, that when they looked at this history of different kinds of maltreatment and exposure to family dysfunction, they realized there was a significant correlation with all of the most common causes of disease and early death in our country today. And in fact, a high, what they called ACE score, was a better predictor of ischemic heart disease in adults than the kind of things that I was trained as a family doctor to look at. So we also have been gathering data here in Alaska about a history of childhood trauma. And so we find over a third of Alaskan adults report that they have a history of physical or sexual abuse, physical neglect, which means not getting basic needs met, or emotional neglect, which means not getting that support and nurturing as a child. So again, this is really common in Alaska and not just in Southern California. So this just gives you an idea of some of the things that Alaskan adults are reporting in the surveys that have been done. And it definitely takes a toll. So people that have sustained at least 4 or more of these categories of either abuse, neglect, or family dysfunction are much more likely to be unemployed, unable to work, to report that they have poor health. And it's not just one bad thing. So one of the things from the original ACEs study is that somebody had an ACE score of 1. They were highly likely, like 87% likely, that their ACE score was going to be more than 1. So these things tend to occur in clusters in family. So this is a very, very busy slide. But the important thing, this is Alaska data, to show that here in Alaska, if somebody reported that they were physically abused as a child, there was a basically 36% chance that they also were sexually abused, an over 78% chance that they were verbally or emotionally abused, 42% chance that there was a parent or caregiver that was mentally ill. So it's these things tend to cluster in families. So this, again, just to emphasize that the more these bad things that accumulate, there is that trauma does, we know now from brain science, there's an impact on development of the brain and the nervous system. And there's also this new emerging research that this has an impact on genetics, which is probably one of the scariest but also most hopeful things that we're finding out, because there may be a way to reverse some of these effects. We do know that these impacts actually start prior to birth. I remember as a family physician in my early training being told that, oh, babies are really well protected from stress when they're growing inside their uterus, and we know now that's actually not true, that these prenatal exposures really can have an impact. And they have an impact both on this brain development and probably genetics, but also have an impact on kids' ability to be both vulnerable and resilient going forward after they're born and on into adulthood. And so, an example everyone's aware of is fetal alcohol syndrome. So that's a prenatal exposure that creates permanent brain changes that then impact that child throughout the rest of their lifespan. But there's also some research, for example, that shows that women who had a very serious traumatic event during their pregnancy, their children would be more likely to be admitted for asthma later on after they were born. So again, it's just a matter as the research unfolds, I think we're going to have better answers as to how we start addressing these problems. Some of this really does have to do with brain development. So these are, there's a photo of an infant brain and a photo of an adult brain. You can see there's quite a bit of difference. And that's because that baby brain really is meant to be able to grow and develop in response to the kind of things that that baby will experience after birth. For those that, this is a micro view of the brain. So you can see at birth, there aren't a lot of those nerve cells, and there aren't nearly as many of those connections between those nerve cells. But for anybody who's had kids, you know how much as kids are growing, especially in that first 5 or 6 years of life, their brains are filling up with so much information. And then as they start hitting their teen years, the brain actually goes through a time of pruning, because if that part of the brain doesn't need to use that skill, they may prune that part of the brain and develop new connections, which is why people who've had teenagers who think they act like they have a half a brain, they really do only have half a brain at that point. But the good news is they develop more of those synaptic connections. Some of the key concepts with this brain development is that those nerves are really designed to change as they're, depending on what they're exposed to in the environment. That brain is really dependent on getting those environmental cues. It's why they try to make sure if you've got a baby whose eye isn't pointing the right direction, that's something that has to be addressed early on, because the brain has to learn how to see. And if there's disruption of that or lack of cues to those important parts of the brain isn't going to learn those skills. And the other thing is that those skills have to develop in a certain order. So a newborn baby has to learn how to regulate their heart rate and their temperature, and learn how to coordinate sucking and swallowing, and how to communicate with crying before they can learn those more advanced skills that happen as they get older. We also now know that in addition to learning all those kind of motor skills, babies also have to learn how to form relationships and how to deal with stress. And the relationship that they have with their caregivers is really critical with helping them to learn those kind of skills. And if they have these toxic stressors, so these ACEs that are occurring, it's really going to interfere with their brain development. And in fact, there are actual measurable changes that take place in the brain. So you can find those changes in the brainstem, so that part of the brain that's responsible for kind of regulating things like heart rate. You can find those changes in the limbic system, which helps us to be able to regulate emotions and mood. And you can absolutely find those changes in the upper part of the brain that's responsible for that critical thinking. So there are two, when kids are born, there's a couple of different roads that they can travel. So if they've got that safe and nurturing, stable foundation, then they're able to explore their world and they're able to learn and to grow and to develop the skills that they need to be able to function well in the adult world. However, when kids are living in an environment where there's a lot of trauma and chaos, then they end up spending most of their time actually with their brainstem trying to just be able to be in survival mode. And those fight, flight, or freeze kind of ways that they learn to survive are things that can be hardwired and aren't necessarily very productive then when they become adults. So we do know that there are things that can push a child's trajectory. So when parents are well educated and are able to meet their kids' emotional needs, when they read to their kids, when they provide appropriate discipline, when kids can get the health care they need, when they're able to have, you know, an adequate education that starts early, those are things that point children's trajectories for their life upward to give them a better start to their life, as opposed to things like poverty and lack of services and toxic stress, which push them down into that poor health trajectory going forward. So I'm going to turn things over to Jared to talk about some of this research.
Hello. Thank you for allowing us to come in this afternoon and speak with you. I know that we've done this a few years in a row now, and hopefully you've heard of the Alaska Longitudinal Child Abuse and Neglect Linkage Project. And if you haven't, I'm going to just give you a really brief overview. And we also now have a website that's up on the state website that you can go and access it and learn more about it. But this is a novel data source that no other state has right now. And what we've done is that we've taken the limited resources that we have and we've maximized them to turn a cross-sectional study into a longitudinal study so we can follow people over time. What that does is it allows us to accurately estimate risk. Any other way, we kind of estimate it. Or we're coming up with some broad estimations. So what we've done is we've taken the Alaska Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, which is a survey that's conducted in nearly all 50 states. And it's rigorously constructed and it's evaluated. And moms who consent to participate in it, they are offered the survey shortly after birth, and they answer a variety of questions related to the pre-birth experience. Did I get shut off?
No, you're fine.
You can still hear? Okay. Their pre-birth experience during their birth and shortly after delivery. And utilizing those that information, we've integrated it with administrative data sources like the permanent fund dividend so that we can track when the population is still in the state. Because if they're not here, they're no longer at risk for being detected for other things, so we need to stop trying to follow them in our denominator. And we've also linked them with child welfare records. So we can estimate the risk of when you're born in the state, the risk of having contact with child welfare being screened in, substantiated, and removed. And we use those as pseudo proxies for something that happened in the home or someone felt it was necessary to call and report that. And we, our goal is to integrate with as many administrative data sources as we can when we have a need to do just that. And so this is just an image that kind of describes that relationship there. And the wonderful thing about PRAMS is that it's population-based weighted. So we don't have to link every birth that occurs in this state. We can actually link this survey response and use the rich data that lives within the PRAMS response. From these data, and we're tracking this every year, we increase these linkages, we've learned that before the age of 9 now, last year I presented before the age of 8, that 37% of kids that are born in Alaska will be reported to child welfare before the age of 9. So that's over a third. That's a large proportion of the kids that are born in our state that have some contact with the child welfare system. And we use that as an area within public health as something that we want to address and try to intervene on. When we look at the different estimates that we have related to child maltreatment or the burden of what people experience, generally what we're accustomed to seeing is the prevalence estimate that we see reported from child welfare, where it's about 10% of the child population 0 to 17 has a contact with child welfare in an annual year. And that's the estimate that we're more accustomed to seeing. But the adult prevalence that from the BRFSS survey indicates, and Kathy just shared it, that 34% of adults report experiencing some form of abuse and neglect during their childhood, which is a pseudo proxy for the risk that or lifetime burden that a child experiences in their lifetime. So as we measure the cumulative incidence, we would expect our estimate to closely match that 34% or exceed it, because now we're measuring actual events as they occur, as well as using a proxy. When you ask a survey on BRFSS, people might interpret things a little bit differently, and here we're using a standardized metric of having contact with child welfare as an endpoint. And so we have these three different estimates up here so that we can have a contextualization of what these different estimates mean. Yes?
When you say they have a contact with OCS, is that a report of harm or is that substantiated?
It's a report of harm, and I'm going to show you a slide that differentiates those for you.
Madam Chair,
Representative Drummond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, what is BRSS? I think I missed an explanation.
Yes, thank you. Through the Chair, the BRFSS is the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System.
Thank you.
So what this looks like with respect to reported, screened in, substantiations, and removals is that these are each estimates that we can look at uniquely if we switched what the endpoint of interest is. So among kids born in the state of Alaska, approximately one out of every three will have a report of harm to child welfare before the age of 9. Before the age of 9, approximately one out of every four will have a report screened in. Approximately one out of every eight will have a report substantiated. And approximately one out of every 16 will be removed for any amount of time from their home before the age of 9. So this is also a pretty busy slide for you, but it breaks it down now by the different report types. So we can look at a report for physical abuse, a report for sexual abuse, a report for mental injury, and a report for neglect, which are the four classifications that these buckets get created within the Office of Children's Services. And below each of those cumulative incidence graphs, I've provided just some breakouts of before age, if we looked at before age 1, what the percentage would be of kids born in our state that would have that contact before the age of 5 and before the age of 11. What's nice about these cumulative incidence estimates is that if we were interested in understanding before age 3, before age 1, or before age 2, we can actually calculate those estimates because it's a cumulative measure during the developmental periods of kids over their life course trajectory. And there's a link there directly for you. You can go to the state website and navigate directly to these data. And you can navigate on this website different data sites by some different demographics as well. So I only have one other point related to the data. These data have a ton of information that I could be providing to you, but usually with information and data, I found that I can give data overload very quickly because I start getting excited, I start talking quickly, and I start using words that sometimes I know what they mean, but no one knows what they mean. But a lot of people think that I do ACEs research, but I don't. What I do is to help us understand ACEs and understand what we can do about ACEs. So when you think about ACEs, they classify household dysfunction, which are all these things, as measured by maternal illness, incarcerated relative, mother was treated violently, substance abuse, and divorce. And then they have abuse and neglect. And you can kind of look at those two things as abuse and neglect is something that that child or individual experienced directly, and the household dysfunction is the environment in which that kid is developing. And when we looked at those data, we actually have a way to measure household dysfunction before the kid's even born. So what we can say is, what's the state of the household before the kid's even born? And we can measure what's the ACE score that a kid has at birth. And so it's something that they actually have relative to household dysfunction. And can that predict them having additional ACEs of abuse and neglect over their lifetime? So we stratified, we looked at the maternal responses to these household dysfunction questions before delivery, and then we looked at child welfare reports as a proxy measure for abuse and neglect. And what we found, not shockingly, is that the more of those household dysfunctions that the mom reported, the more likely it is that that child's going to have contact with child welfare before the age of 9. And it follows that exact same trajectory that almost all the ACEs research shows with any insert negative health outcome or negative bad outcome. And what it is that if you have an accumulation of bad things going on in life, it impacts your ability to appropriately do rearing and make a safe place for that kid to develop. Because we have additional data sources and those household dysfunctions don't adequately completely describe household dysfunction, we've added in some additional dysfunctions that we know through the literature are strongly related independently to having contact with child welfare or child maltreatment. And that includes things like financial stress, having arguments with a partner or someone close to you, being homeless, partner didn't want the pregnancy in the first place, and partner threatening or limiting your activities. And what we found is that relative to children that are born into homes with zero or one of those household dysfunctions, because you know dysfunction can occur in every household, but these are very specific types of dysfunctions. But if we compare those who have zero or one of them, if you have only three dysfunctions, you're 140% more likely to be reported to OCS before the age of 9. And if you have five or more at birth, you're 361% more likely to be reported to OCS before the age of 9. The take-home message from this is that we're utilizing population-based data to help us be able to predict where we can attack our resources effectively for prevention and being able to provide services to these families adequately and identify those who need them.
All right, so I'm going to just briefly talk about some of the hard economic costs for this. So, nationally, in the United States, each year the lifetime burden. So, if you take a group of people that have sustained child maltreatment, it's costing the country somewhere between $433.7 billion and $2 trillion in 2016 U.S. dollars. And that's between a couple of different research studies that looked at very conservative numbers versus more liberal numbers. Here in Alaska, using that same way of calculating, the cost to us each year is between $631 million to $10.7 billion each year. There's also some additional Alaska research that suggests that the cost for substantiated reports of child abuse cost us each year $82 million, and that's just for childhood health care, for child welfare costs, and for special education. That 40.6% of adult Medicaid enrollment is linked to adverse childhood experiences, and there are estimates that just in the costs related to Medicaid, smoking, diabetes, binge drinking, arthritis, and obesity, if we could decrease ACEs and maltreatment and improve our response to maltreatment in our state, we could save our state $92 million annually. So how do we address this? As I said, I think there's reason for hope. I don't think the ship is entirely sailed for anyone at any point in their lifespan. I think our brains are always capable of learning. All of us can play a role in building resilience in children, and we all have a role in protecting children in our state. certainly having, once things have happened to children, having early and effective intervention is really critical, and I think child advocacy centers in our state have played an important role in that, where kids can have a multidisciplinary response. Most of our hub communities in the state do have a child advocacy center providing services for kids who have already experienced some kind of maltreatment. And we're seeing a lot of kids. If you can see, again, most of our hub communities do have a child advocacy center, and as of the end of fiscal year 18, CACs in Alaska provided services to over 30,000 children and their families. So how do we create the very best trajectory, the best future for our children's lives? We know that their development is going to be influenced by both these negative and positive factors, and I wish we could prevent kids from ever experiencing any kind of adversity or any kind of trauma, and we know that we can't, so trying to really emphasize and build on all these positive factors, which will increase their capacity for resilience, I think is really critical. We know what those protective factors are, and those protective factors really focus on what adults do and not asking children to be able to protect themselves. So we know that having a supportive, nurturing, stable family and supportive social networks are really critical, that there are caring adults that are available outside the home, that there are household rules and kids that are monitored and kept safe from their normal childhood behaviors that can put them in danger, that there's parental employment and adequate housing, that there's access to health care and other services that kids may need, that there's a feeling of safety in communities, and that there's community involvement in valuing children and keeping them safe. So I think everyone has something that they can do. Everyone has a role. Just a reminder that April is Child Abuse Prevention and Awareness Month, and The motto this year is Dare to Be the One. So it's daring to be the one that makes the report, daring to be the one that stands up for kids, daring to be the one that has a positive intervention. So I think this isn't, you know, when we talk about, you know, 34% of adults, of Alaskan adults, are reporting that they were physically or sexually abused or emotionally maltreated. That's, you know, that's a lot of Alaskans. And those who are family members or loved ones of those people that were, you know, that had these terrible things happen when they were children, they're impacted as well. So this impacts all of us in Alaska. This isn't us versus them. I think it's important that we encourage and allow people to break the silence and talk about the things that have happened and how this impacted them. I think when you're making your very difficult decisions about budgetary items, we all have to be using this trauma-informed lens. And when we get frustrated with, you know, with for example, a domestic violence victim that won't, you know, goes back to her partner, we need to remember to be asking, you know, what happened to you instead of what's wrong with you. I think we need to be supporting approaches that really do help to strengthen children and families so that we actually can have less state intervention into families' life. Into families' lives, and there really are some exciting things that are happening in our state right now with the Strengthening Families Initiative, Help Me Grow, and the Alaska Resilience Initiative. Some communities are also really working with sort of this collective impact kind of model, like in Mat-Su and down in Homer, where they're, again, trying to put great minds in these communities together to try to solve this problem as a community. And so I think all of us need to be supporting those community-based initiatives. So I think we do have data that shows that we have a lot of Alaskan adults that are bearing the burden of this lifetime accumulation of family violence and dysfunction, that this starts early and, in fact, starts prenatally, and we can predict it. And we're paying for it now with these lifetime care costs, and we need to figure out how to be investing before so that we don't bear these costs going forward. So we definitely need prevention. We need early recognition. We need early, effective, timely intervention. We need effective treatment and effective treatments that are available. So having wait lists of 6 months for a child that's been sexually abused is just not okay. And we really need to focus on supporting these healthy and stable and nurturing families and communities so our kids can grow up to be very successful adults. And then I'd like to turn things over to Mike to talk with us, to just put very real faces to what we've been discussing.
Thanks, Kathy. I don't know about you all, but every time I hear these two talk, I can't get my mind around this stuff. 37% of Alaskans. I've been practicing as a adolescent psychologist for 40 years. And that entire time, I've been working with abused, neglected kids. It took me about the first 10 years of practicing to understand that. And I worked with kids in all kinds of facilities. So when they asked me to kind of try to give you a face of child abuse, I had a really hard time. There are so many of them. Look around the room, you'll see figure a third. But the ones that come most often to me are the ones that I failed to recognize. Now, my colleagues wanted to kind of keep me under control, so they made me write all this stuff down. So I apologize that I'm going to be reading some of this to you. So my very first patient, a kid named Kenny, I met sort of, he was 16 years old, and I met him as he was racing down, sliding on stocking feet down the halls of a locked long-term psychiatric facility in Los Angeles. I think you may need those, not me.
There's one at every scene. Yeah.
He was on the 8th floor of the LA County Medical Center. He was laughing hysterically at the staff that chased him. I wanted him as a patient on site. I was told he was an incorrigible delinquent who had attempted to hang himself after setting his room on fire at one of the local correctional facilities. Senior staff at the psychiatric hospital assured me that he'd only done so to escape his correctional consequences. If so, Kenny didn't succeed. I stayed in touch with Kenny over the course of the next 20 years. He spent those years incarcerated and ultimately ended up at Supermax prison in Pelican Bay for assaulting an inmate accused of molesting children. Kenny would be about 56 years old today, but he died years ago, 3 weeks after being let out on a compassionate release. I never did ask him why he tried to kill himself as a teenager. Likewise, I didn't ask a crippled 15-year-old prostitute whose name I can't remember, but I was asked to visit her in an emergency unit two floors down from Kenny, why she jumped off a four-story parking structure. I was told she was just depressed. And I didn't stand up for a 14-year-old teen in the same unit who complained that one of the nursing staff had fondled her. That was quietly swept under the rug, and nobody bothered to ask about the father of her child, and so neither did I. We all just assumed she was a loose woman. I didn't know at that time how to ask these kids the hard but obvious questions. For a time, I accepted the professional party line. They were disturbed and disturbing kids, but I couldn't forget them. And it wasn't until I went to work in the early 80s in the nation's first residential facility specifically designed for abused, neglected children in the Dry Hills near Palm Springs, California, that I began to understand them. I came to Alaska soon thereafter, and it's been Alaska's children who have tutored me ever since. I've come to recognize it as child abuse, and especially child sexual abuse, that is indeed disturbed and disturbing, not the kids who survive it. But the survivors don't easily or typically disclose. They prefer to tell in behaviors that can make you feel the same way that many of them will feel their entire lives: helplessly angry, fearful, and hopeless. And I have to constantly remind myself that those feelings are not my own, because child abuse is kind of contagious. Sit in a room with them and you'll start feeling those. I have to remind myself that I am not hopeless. I'm not fearful, but I am angry. I'm angry that now that we know, and we didn't when I started in this field, now that we know that we can still turn away from disturbing children of all ages, now that we know how to recognize who they are, we still turn away from them. And we don't ask the hard questions or seek the real answers. It's the face of one of those more recently forgotten children that haunts my nights nowadays. You could clearly see, I'll call her Hope. in a number of online child pornography videos that the FBI confiscated about a year ago. She was a 26-year-old woman who was cheerfully helping very young children perform horrible sex acts on tape. Over the course of nearly 12 hours of interview in Fairbanks Correctional Center, this young woman patiently explained in the voice and words of a 5-year-old to me that she learned to do so as a kindergartner, caught up in a sadomasochistic sex ring in Milwaukee. She called it the playhouse. The only way she could help the other children trapped her in the playhouse with her, not get hurt, not get killed, was to show them how to please a circle of sick men with unbelievably sick needs. Abused throughout her childhood, even when eventually taken into the state of Alaska's custody as a young pre-adolescent, she remained most fearful still of the men of the playhouse as a young adult. She thought she'd found sanctuary with her co-defendant, an older man who promised he would never let anyone hurt her. When he turned out to be interested in very young girls and wanted her help photographing them, well, that all seemed normal. And she did what she could, like she did as a 5-year-old, to make sure they didn't get hurt. I explained to her federal judge at sentencing that hers were not the acts of a criminal, but acts of a kind of heroism I have seen before, but only in the insanely abusive secret world of child sexual exploitation. I will forever be angry and haunted that the judge turned away from this heroic young lady and sentenced her to 22 years in federal prison, righteously insisting she should have known better. But in a way, he was right. She should have known better. And it's a responsibility of those of us that have to see, that have known better, to see that all children in Alaska know better. Children like the 36-year-old mother, whose 2 young children were recently taken into foster care after she left them alone during a blackout drunk. I sat across from her, I haven't come up with a name that I can share with you for her yet, in a coffee shop along the way on a trip down to Anchorage a couple weeks ago. She couldn't afford a trip to Fairbanks to visit her kids. The 2 young children had been taken away recently. I was working with a 5-year-old, and I wanted a little history to help the person who was caring for him. The woman's tired eyes were my first clue. She explained that she never sleeps. She suffers from chronic panic attacks. She even offered that she'd been diagnosed as bipolar and a borderline personality disorder. She'd, in fact, been on psychiatric medication for years now. She'd been in counseling for 12 years with one therapist in Louisiana and had recently begun with another here in Alaska. So this was not someone who's trying to run away from her problems. But nothing really seemed to help. As a rule, she didn't drink. Her hated mother was a mean alcoholic, her father an addict. But she'd found that if occasionally she drank to the point of blackout, she'd hit a sort of reset button and could start over the next day and keep going. This was all she knew about herself. After years of mental health support, she'd accepted that she was a broken person who was periodically under attack from her own feelings. She herself had survived a childhood with divorced parents who fought bitterly over their 3 children. Both parents partied hard every night as the children bounced between a rock and a hard place. Our mother, the oldest, had no memory from the age of 8 to 13 years old, except for the fact that during those years she discovered her love of horses that sustained her to this day. Her 2 young siblings eventually both became psychiatrically disabled. For reasons she could not fathom and could not recall, her younger brother hates her to this day bitterly. A loving grandmother gave this young woman her shelter and paid for riding lessons and saved her life. She married young to a much older man she loved, bred and raised racehorses, and had a son. But she left them unexpectedly and without explanation after 10 years for reasons she couldn't understand. She was afraid to continue caring for her own son. She hadn't slept for more than a couple hours for as long as she could remember. This is the face of abuse you'll often see with OCS parents. They're folks that survive things they can barely remember and yet constantly fear. This poor woman wasn't having panic attacks. She was having repetitive daymares from chronic REM deprivation. I used to be a sleep researcher. Nightmares from an abusive childhood that could find no safe release and maybe resolution in the privacy of her sleeping mind, and so exploded into her waking life without context. Why chronic sleep problems? As a child, she and her sibs were told to remain in their rooms no matter what while their parents partied every night. Alone, unprotected, and I'm certain prey to all sorts of predators, her adult mind could only protect her so much from the memory of what happened to her during those party nights and from what she learned to do. It could not protect her from the reminders that were her own children. And so her fears worsened. Her vigilance remained constant and sleep unthinkable. Her tired eyes filled with tears as I assured her of the strength of her mind and goodness of her heart and explained her shattered life to her. She slept 5 hours a night after crying for 3 the following night. She now has the difficult, but I'm convinced, doable task of putting together a life that won't repeat her past. She is what we call a survivor, and she should have known better. So we are here to make sure you know better. Know that 1/3 of the children of Alaska come to the attention of OCS by the time they are 8. This is a large, silent constituency that needs your voice and understanding in any budgetary discussion. And they need the can-do genius of Alaska's frontier if we are ever to make a dent in that startling statistic. Thanks.
And that was Dr. Mike Hopper for the record. If you could submit your written comments to make it a little bit easier for our recording secretary to
sure.
honor your words, that'd be wonderful.
Yep.
Are there any questions for our presenters today?
I just want to make a comment. Thank you. A year ago in March, Representative Sponholz and I, as chair of Health and Social Services, and I as chair of House Education, held 3 meetings, and I think we heard from some of you guys, and I heard some of this information for the first time, particularly the questioning of young moms. It sounded like it just passed out too. The questioning of young moms as to what happened to them prenatally, even pre-pregnancy. And I can't remember what I had for dinner last week, never mind what happened to me, you know, in the months before I got pregnant. And this is just incredible information, and I really appreciate the way you have put it together. And the fact that Alaska has this unique system now that is unique to us as among the states, this is really important information. And I, for one, will take this away and make sure to be a strong advocate for the outcomes that you are hoping for us to make possible through this. Thank you very much.
Our pleasure. One of the reasons for us coming before you all is I've been working with this task force for a number of years, and I can tell you, as just an online mental health provider, you have a world of expertise here, and they're here to help you in any aspect. They'll do research, they know the people that you need to know, they need people all over the country. They're an invaluable resource for you.
So, one of the things I think that your data in particular, Dr. Parrish, sort of says to me is it creates an opportunity for us as a state. We've often thought to ourselves as policymakers, what is it that we do to make sure that we're getting services and supports to the right people? And the sort of say and pray strategy of preventing childhood abuse and neglect, you know, hasn't proven to be extremely effective. But now we know more about who are the kinds of families that are probably most at risk and might benefit most from supports and interventions. And I'm wondering if you have any comments about what opportunities are there or what sort of next steps you think might be there to address sort of the resiliency of families and the supports, the kind of supports that you think that families need to have.
based on that data.
I can make a quick comment related to these data. The earthquake that we recently had was a really good reminder that if you're not prepared, it's hard to help yourself. And so the initial part of having any new data is about educating yourself and making sure you really understand the context of the situation. And until these data, we didn't really understand the context of the situation of where we could target and do prevention. And public health is really trying to address this issue because it's related to all the health effects we're trying to prevent. And so the foundation of the public health model is built upon good data. And so I look at data, and I've been working with Mike, and every question I'm like thinking of how I can analyze that, and he's always laughing. But I've also learned that this is us too. And like, I'm an analyst, but I live in communities and I have different communities around me. And so these data don't become real until I actually contextualize them into my own life. And that didn't happen until I took the Strengthening Families, Strengthening Families?
It's a curriculum.
Yeah, that was taught. And that gave me some simple tools that I could incorporate into my own life that I could start utilizing. And now with the knowledge of how we can prevent and target these things, we can do things that are a little bit more grandiose. So Mike gave you a description of the real extreme scenario of this. But we know that a lot of kids are reported for acts of neglect, where if we had a system built in place to help support these families early on that could detect that, maybe those would never even come to the attention and require those resources from the child welfare. So I think that we're at that point of tipping. I'm providing consultation to Colorado. They want to improve their home visiting model based on the research that I presented. We're replicating this model in Oregon so that we can compare our numbers with them and pool estimates when we have small population numbers. So we're on this cusp of having an explosion of information, and it will be our task of like, now what do we do with it? And maybe Kathy has some ideas related to that.
Yeah, there certainly are models like the nurse family partnership, so home visiting programs, Nutoxovic is another good example of that. And those are great at targeting some of these high-risk families, but I think what this data will allow us to do is be sure we're targeting the right people with the right interventions, and B, also to maybe try to find innovative interventions for families that aren't quite as expensive as the nurses, for example, these nurse home visiting programs. So I think there may be some better alternative, not better, but other alternatives that may work just as well that are targeted specifically at the needs of particular families and their communities.
I'll tell you one opportunity I think we're missing constantly. Two, actually. One of the hardest parts I've found of reaching out, and I specialize in boys, so they're hard to pin down and they're really hard to drag into an office. And it's always been one of the greatest difficulties I have is sort of capturing them. They're like, you know, fireflies. Some of them not literally, but what I learned 30-something years ago when I was the first psychologist at FYF, Fairbanks Youth Facility, is that they were all, there's a bunch of them we already captured. Go over to McLaughlin, go to the Juno Youth Service, walk in the door and just start asking them, well, so what happened to you, son? I did a group for 25 years there called Childhood Issues. It was all about them explaining, I didn't know the term then, ACEs and their abuse. All of them. Mm-hmm. And they just grow up to be adults, and most of them, unfortunately, go back to jail. There's an opportunity. We have those fireflies captured in a bottle, and all we do is kind of be mad at them and make them, you know, accept consequences for their actions. But no one took accepted responsibility for the actions of the people who neglected to abuse them. And there's an opportunity there. I work with a reentry worker in Fairbanks. All we do is staff abuse issues. And she's the adult in the adult program. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Similarly, folks, we're learning now that what we call chronic mental illness, when you ask and you pull back the medications and you start asking the history beyond, is your aunt and who else is in your family psychiatrically ill so we can blame it on genetics? When you start asking them, what you find out is they are unbelievable stories of massive abuse and neglect. It is heartbreaking because all they've been told, like this woman you just met, is she's borderline personality, right? She's bipolar. Her feelings aren't working. Yeah, duh, right? And she has panic attacks. They're told to not even trust their own emotions. Our psychiatric facilities, which we can't keep open anymore, are bottles full of fireflies. We can, the people we need, because they're going to get out one day, and they're going to have families. We have them in place, and we can help them. When you begin talking to them about it, it doesn't take much, but you have to bring it to them. They're hiding from it, right? That's what a lot of mental illness is, hiding from those histories. We can recognize them, even without them telling us, is what I'm telling you.
So, you know, I think what you've just said, Dr. Hopper, sort of underscores the need to, you know, have appropriate response and supports for our young people that have been hurt. A lot of kids that have make it into incarceration are, you know, they've already been hurt pretty badly.
Yeah.
And we should continue to do that, but we also, I think, need to be looking sort of upstream to try to find families that can become that kid before he becomes that kid.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the thing that we have not done a very good job of in our child welfare system. Our child welfare system, you know, sort of, it starts with, you know, a report of harm, and then, you know, if it's serious enough to be screened in or substantiated, which is a small number of the total number of reports of harm that are made every year, then, you know, then they sort of get sucked into the system, and the system itself creates more trauma. And so it's almost like we need to start, you know, we need to move way upstream and start trying, you know, more creative approaches to start supporting at-risk families, which we're now identifying. And I think our challenge is to figure out how to take the data that we have, the information that we have, and say, okay, these are the families that are likely to be at risk, and how is it that we can meet those families and provide some supports for them so that the kid never gets that hurt, so those parents get to experience the profound joy that those of us that are parents get to have by having, you know, a healthy relationship with our children. And I'll just sort of call out, I think, some of the really interesting work that is being done, for example, at Rock Matsu, which is being organized by the Matsu Health Foundation, where they're trying to find ways to intervene much earlier with at-risk families with specific evidence-based or promising practice, you know, strategies. And they're, you know, right in conversations right now with the Office of Children's Services about how to do some sort of appropriate information sharing that doesn't, you know, doesn't put families at risk of, you know, their information being shared inappropriately, but they get access to the kinds of supports and services that they need. Because I think we know a lot of the families that are in child welfare system, by the time the kid gets removed, you know, their family's really crumbled at that point in time. And if we could just give them a little support a lot sooner, those families could be maintained, kids would experience a lot less harm, and all of our communities would be better off for it. That was a lot to just sort of put out there in a short moment, but I think you guys have raised a lot of very important issues, and I appreciate your work. I appreciate your expertise. You guys have dedicated your lives to this work, and I'm very grateful, and thank you for coming and presenting to the committee today.
Thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you.
Yes, that's right. All right, so now we are going to turn our attention to House Bill 22. We're going to take a moment, an Addie's moment, for the room to clear. House Bill 22, Representative Tarr.
Madam Chair, I don't have any additional information unless members have any questions. Appreciate the opportunity to have the bill back before us.
All right, is there any questions about HB 22, Extend the Suicide Prevention Council? All right, if there's no questions, then I would entertain a motion to move the bill from the committee.
Madam Chair. Chair Sponholz, I move House Bill 22, Work Order 31-L, as in labor, S as in Sam, 0258/A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? All right, seeing none, HB 22 passes from committee. We're going to go and take a quick at ease while we sign this. Our attention to House Bill 29, Insurance Coverage for Telehealth. Bernice Nesbitt, my aide, will come forward. You want to put yourself on the record and give us just a very brief recap of the legislation?
Sure. For the record, Bernice Nesbitt, staff to Representative Sponholz. We are still looking at HB 29-31-LS-0274/A. Section 1 is requiring that insurers under Title 21 reimburse providers for providing healthcare services via telehealth. Section 2 defines healthcare insurer and telehealth. And Section 3 applies to insurance plans under Title 21. This bill will take effect on those plans July 1st of 2020. And then Section 4 is the effective date of July 1st, 2020.
All right. Are there any additional questions on HB 29, Insurance Coverage for Telehealth? All right. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from the committee.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 29, Work Order 31-L as in labor, S as in Sam, 0274/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections to this motion? All right. Seeing none, the bill passes from committee, and we're going to take another at ease to sign the report. Now we are going to turn our attention to HB 97, Telehealth Physicians Assistance Drugs. We have Reed Harris, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins today here to give us a brief recap of the bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I was here to answer questions. If you'd like a recap, I'm more than happy to do that. Thank you.
Briefly.
Thank you, yes. House Bill 97 increases patient access to care, particularly for rural and medically underserved areas. As stated previously, it's a cleanup bill from the 2016 Medicaid reform bill, Senate Bill 74. It is also the companion bill to Senate Bill 44 over on the Senate side. When the Medicaid reform bill went through, it allowed physicians to engage in telehealth services within the state of Alaska. However, the state medical board determined that physician's assistants were unable to do that because they weren't specifically listed in the bill. A physician's assistant is a clinician that can take medical histories, perform physical exams, do lab tests, diagnosis, treatment plans, prescribe medications, and assist in surgery. They have extensive medical training, which we went over in the previous committee. Passage of this bill would allow approximately 700 licensed PAs in Alaska to provide telemedicine in the same manner as physicians, extending the reach of medicine to patients in underserved areas. And most of Alaska has a shortage of health professionals, and the entire state is a medically underserved area. This bill seeks to correct that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harris. Are there any questions for Mr. Harris on the bill? All right, I don't believe that we have any amendments on this bill. Public testimony in this bill on this bill was left open at the last committee hearing. Is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? It looks like we have Deborah Stovern with the Department of Commerce who's on the phone in case anybody has any questions. Do you have the question? Yep. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you. Deborah, is that her name?
Deborah Stovern, yep.
Yeah. Just real quick, just to make sure I understand, because we had a little bit of conversation the other day about this. Basically, if I understood it correctly, the medical board had just, the reason that this is necessary is because the medical board had read the initial statute through SB 54 to read that the physician's assistants were not included. But is it of your opinion that the intent under 74 was that physician's assistants would be included? We just wrote the statute wrong?
Thank you. This is, for the record, this is Deborah Stovarn with the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, and I serve as the Executive Administrator for the Alaska State Medical Board. I couldn't tell you what the intent of that Medicaid reform bill was regarding physician assistance, and it is my understanding as the board considered this issue regarding physician assistance practicing telehealth, because the statute was written specifically with the word physician in it and not physician assistant, it's my understanding that the medical board felt they couldn't determine the legislature's intent regarding physician assistance, and so other stakeholders came forward and asked that these bills be brought forward and clarify that physicians and physicians' assistants would be covered under these statutes.
So the medical board covers physicians' assistants as well as the physicians?
Through the chair, yes, they do.
Okay, and then one last question.
Mm-hmm.
So the only concern I have is, and I don't think it's a concern, actually. It's just one thing I just want to make sure is clear. Obviously, more people able to prescribe when we're dealing, because this does allow them mm-hmm. the opportunity to prescribe all the way up to Schedule IIs, which have some challenges that we're dealing with. Is this physician's assistants are already able to prescribe, so we've already given them that authority to prescribe up to that level. Do you in any way see some sort of potential challenge in now making it so that they don't have to interact with someone? Could this potentially cause, because fortunately, when it comes to physicians, so at least experience, most are good actors. Of course, every once in a while we do have some bad actors, and thankfully we're able to deal with them. Do you see this potentially opening up a door, or do you feel that there are mechanisms that you have in place or that the board can put in place to ensure that we're not putting more people out there with the ability to prescribe, even though they don't have that direct interaction? They can do it through telephone, which is an easier method to be able to give someone an opportunity to gain access to those controlled substances.
Two things I'd like to touch on in answer to that question. The first is that part of the statute requires the board to adopt a nationally published guideline for practicing telehealth, and the board has done that regarding physicians. The board adopted the Federation of State Medical Board policy on telehealth and the American Medical Association guidelines regarding telehealth practice. And I would anticipate that they would extend those same guidelines to physician assistants practicing this way. The other thing we talked about a little bit the other day was the collaborative plan under which a physician assistant derives their scope of practice and their supervising physician grants the scope of practice allowed to that physician assistant through the collaborative plan, including what types of prescriptive authority an individual physician assistant would have and what kind of practice that physician assistant could engage in, and that would include whatever telehealth practice supervising physician would allow that physician assistant to engage in, and so the physician would be directly involved with that. And as we all, under this statute, obviously trust our physicians to do it it seems appropriate to extend that to the physician assistants that are being supervised by those physicians.
Ms. Stovern, are you using a speakerphone? There seems to be a little bit of interference in the connection. It's making it a little difficult to understand you.
I'm sorry. Let me see if I can correct that.
Yeah, thank you.
Is that any better?
Yeah.
Yeah. The feedback is gone.
Do you have another question?
No, I think I actually that was good, and I appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Stovern, this is Representative Sponholz. Can you just confirm that physicians' assistants have to utilize the prescription drug monitoring database?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, they do. They are required under those statutes to anyone prescribing controlled substances needs to use the PDMP. Anyone with a DEA registration needs to register for the PDMP. So that would already does apply to physician assistants and would certainly apply to physician assistants engaging in prescribing your telehealth.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That may be one of the most important tools, actually, that we have at our disposal to manage opioid prescription. Is there any other questions for either the bill's sponsor staff or for Ms. Stovern? All right. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony unless there's anybody in the room that would like to testify. All right. Doesn't look like it. So, seeing that we haven't received any amendments by the deadline, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Madam Chair, I move the CS for House Bill 97, Work Order 31-L Labor S SAM 0695/M, from committee with individual recommendations and attached FISL note.
Are there any objections to moving this bill from committee? All right, seeing none. The CS for HB 97 passes from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease while committee members sign the report. Turn our attention to HB 86, Mental Health Hospitals, Contracts, and Bids. Representative Fields, you and your staff, Tristan Walsh, want to put yourselves on the record and introduce your legislation?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Zach Fields, House District 20.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields.
Madam Chairwoman, thank you for the opportunity to present this bill, House Bill 86, and you're looking at a CS.
I think we might need to introduce the CS so we can speak from the CS, and I believe that we have a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that the Health and Social Services Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 86, Work Order Number 31-L Labor S SAM 0623/U, as a working document.
All right, and I will object for the purposes of conversation or of discussion. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. House Bill 86 has a simple purpose. It would prevent wholesale privatization of Alaska Psychiatric Institute. I should note it does not prevent partial privatization of individual services or components within API, some of which already exist. I think we've all watched with concern as there's been what I would call a rush to judgment in terms of contracting with a specific company whose record I'll get to in a little bit. We've heard in public forums, certainly in Anchorage, that workers at Alaska Psychiatric Institute are very committed to the public mission of API. They're very committed to their patients, and unfortunately, have lacked the resources and the managerial support to do their job safely and to provide for the safety of residents. So really my purpose with this bill is let's provide for a safe environment for both residents of API as well as workers, and that, in my mind, that requires public management. As I mentioned, the committee substitute simply prevents wholesale permanent privatization of API. This bill would not in any way undo the temporary contract that the state has with WellPath, nor would it prevent privatization of individual components of services, and this bill is drafted to be consistent with the consultant's report on privatization that the legislature directed under SB 74. Just a little background on API. It opened in 1962 as part of the Alaska Mental Health Enabling Act. It has been part of the public system since then. Unfortunately, as you know, the capacity at API has fallen far below what it used to be and what it needs to be to serve our community. API is a 24/7 safety net provider of inpatient psychiatric care. And I think it's important to note it serves a really broad range of people, including seniors who have complex behavioral health issues who could be better served elsewhere. The inadequate capacity at API, I think as committee members are aware, causes hospitals to hold folks 24/7 with one-on-one guards, and that in turn passes on significant cost to our healthcare system more broadly, and those costs are in fact passed on to private payers, including the state. There, going back about 20 years, there has been a great deal of study on privatization of private mental health hospitals and private prisons, and I think the data are pretty overwhelming that there's no compelling evidence that privatization saves money or results in improved quality of care. In fact, the opposite is true. I think some of the most compelling studies are the ones, they're meta studies, so they look at a bunch of studies and find that, in fact, privatization does not save money and, in many cases, worsens care. For that reason, the Department of Justice moved away from using private prisons. And the legislature mandated a private prison study in SB 74. It's a very well-done study. And I think it makes some really sound recommendations in terms of the lack of cost savings from privatizing the entire facility, while it leaves open the possibility that certain components could potentially be privatized with small cost savings without sacrificing the safety of residents. And here's a little excerpt from it. Cost-benefit analysis revealed that even after a significant staff reduction, when all transition costs, contract monitoring costs, and provider margins are considered, privatization proves to be more expensive to the state over a likely five-year contract period. The additional staff reductions needed for budget neutrality would likely diminish the quality of service delivery. And I guess I would just emphasize what we've heard from direct care providers at API is that inadequacy of staffing is a really important safety issue. And when there's a threat to worker safety, and that often in turn has a ripple effect and results in less patient safety at API. It can get a little confusing when you look at what is WellPath, what's its relationship to Geo Group and Correct Care Solutions. So I just want to put this timeline up there to show that Correct Care and WellPath are largely the same company. The Geo Group has been part of WellPath going back a little further in the corporate history. And I don't think I'm going to dwell on this for the moment, but these have been the same companies at different points in their history. WellPath actually has a record in this area, and the record is profoundly disturbing. The company's been sued about 1,400 times. We have a full set of media clippings, and some of them are horrifying to read through. You know, one that really stuck with me was an individual in a WellPath facility who got a cold. The cold progressed to pneumonia. This individual was vomiting. He was bleeding. He was begging for care. WellPath never provided the care. The only care this individual got was buying cough drops at a commissary. And in the end, this individual died in a pool of his own blood and vomit. He never got care from WellPath. And when you look at the 1,400 lawsuits, they aren't outliers. They aren't coincidences. These are direct results of a profit model that sacrifices patient safety for profits. And these are, I'm just going to run through some excerpts very quickly, just again to show this is the record of WellPath. And it's a very consistent record. It's a very troubling record. And again, if we care about patient safety, if we care about worker safety, I think this very troubling record is the reason that we should move forward with House Bill 86.
Representative Fields, I believe Representative Tarr has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if you had a chance in this research, and I'm hoping you did because I didn't. You know, when they came before us, or in one of the conversations I'd had, I'd asked some questions about this, and it was suggested to me that the lawsuits were, and this is where I guess the, let me back up for a moment here, where the sort of history becomes more important to me in this timeline. I have not, having not had an opportunity to study this, they were suggesting that they had sort of the prison piece of their work and then the mental health piece of their work, and that the lawsuits were more associated with the prison piece of their work and not the mental health piece. And I just, it looks like you've done quite a bit of research. I mean from what you saw, is that accurate, or what facilities were you seeing these kind of problems in?
Through the chair, the answer is both the prisons and the private mental health hospitals. The prisons largely through Geo Group, and the private mental health hospitals through Correct Care. Okay. So that, through the chair again, I don't think that's a particularly accurate statement, because both have serious problems.
Okay. And I'd just like to recognize that Representative Josephson joined us at about 4:23 for the record.
And Madam Chairwoman, I guess I would just emphasize, it's not just lawsuits. There are voluminous media reports from locations around the country where WellPath has operated these facilities. And, you know, to me, it's pretty troubling when you have credible, detailed media reports from multiple different facilities about highly specific incidents of negligence and death that all were a result of inadequate care. And I'm not going to dwell on all these again. We have all these in media clips. Folks can examine them at their leisure. I think the record is very clear about this company's history. You know, I've been troubled and thank you to the chairwoman for helping put on an informational hearing where we heard from the department probably 2 months ago now. I've been very troubled that we haven't received any assurances about staffing levels. Or adequacy of care that would give me confidence that we're not going to have in Alaska the same problems that have plagued WellPath and all the other states in which it's operated. There was a newspaper article either early this week or late last week. API has lost 3 more psychiatrists. This is a clip from that news story. Just I think yesterday, WellPath CEO testified they have no plan for addressing an evaluation backlog. And I think the news we see here is just very consistent with the company's record that they don't have a plan for adequate staffing, which, as we know from the history, is really essential to safety for both patients and workers alike. I guess I'd also emphasize, when the department presented this plan several weeks before the budget was presented, they said, oh, we're going to spend a lot more money. We're going to bring a lot more resources to bear through WellPath. And, you know, I guess if there were different circumstances, if this was a partnership with Providence, for example, and we were bringing more resources to bear, I never would have introduced this bill. I don't have a fundamental objection to a different management structure at API. I do have extreme concerns about for-profit management through a company with a long record of negligence, and to see what's essentially a flat budget for API only magnifies those concerns when we know that a significant amount of money is going to get siphoned off to profits for WellPath. And I think I should note, WellPath is owned by a highly leveraged private equity firm. The way that private equity firms extract profits from companies like this is to shortchange care and drive down costs and then typically flip the company. So we not only have a perverse profit motive with WellPath itself, it's even worse because of their owner. There's been some really good press about why outsourcing API to a private equity firm and WellPath is a bad idea. I'd refer to a column in the ADN by Jeremy Mueller from mid-March. And I want to note, again, the legislature wisely commissioned a study to see what savings potentially could be garnered through privatization. And actually, the study that the Alaska legislature commissioned cited WellPath specifically as a reason not to privatize. And I just want to highlight this line. The expected profit margin for a for-profit contractor is 8% based on South Florida State Hospital, which is a WellPath facility. So we have from the governor essentially a flat-funded API budget. We would, if this is any indication about what WellPath expects for profits, we'd be looking at potentially 8%. According to testimony presented by Deputy Commissioner Wall in the informational hearing we held earlier this year, Hess didn't put any sideboards on the profits. We don't have any guarantee that a certain amount of money is going to be going to care versus WellPath profits versus profits for this private equity firm. And when you look at the very high profit margins from other WellPath facilities, again, it just raises even more concerns. So I know a colleague of mine has a bill in the line behind me, so I guess with that, I'll just go to questions, and thank you again to the committee for hearing this bill.
We'll take Representative Tarr's question, and then maybe we can go to the CS description. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back on that timeline, the other thing that kind of troubled me and not having had the time to really research this is just the way these companies have morphed so much. And I was trying to figure out, is it or is there any sort of, you know, when we look at the dates, the deaths, the complaints, kind of, if we can't substantiate it, sort of, you know, correlate it, where, you know, you had one company, a number of lawsuits or problems happen, so then, oops, let's dissolve this company, form a new company. And so, you know, do you sort of see that kind of cycle through, you know, putting together all the research that you've been able to come up with?
Through the chair, it does seem fairly common that companies in this space associate, disassociate. I think the important thing here is Correct Care Solutions had a very long and very troubling history. WellPath is substantially Correct Care Solutions. The Geo Group also had a long and troubling history. Geo Group at this point is not associated with WellPath. There are plenty of other reasons to be concerned about Geo Group in the context mm-hmm. of proposals for prison privatization. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you look at Correct Care Solutions, that is very much part of WellPath.
I think for me, one of the concerns that I have when I see that flow chart of the rebranding time and time again is that, you know, a really solid company with a great reputation is going to want to keep their name the same for a long time because you build brand equity over time. And you know, making that switch on the level of frequency, the frequency at which this company has been rebranded, acquired, sold over the years, sort of indicates that there's not a lot of brand value, which means that they're not building that brand equity, and they don't have a good reputation on which they want to continue to build. So that's a red flag for me.
Madam Chairwoman, if I might add to that point, I think you're absolutely right. Actually, this is a toxic brand. And there have been legislative bodies in other part of the country that have canceled pending contracts with what was called Correct Care because they had such a toxic brand and such mm-hmm. toxic history. And I think that substantially explains why they would want to rename themselves as WellPath.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are there any other questions before we go to the sectional analysis of the CS? All right. Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields. If it pleases the committee, I'll take you through the sectional analysis for committee substitute House Bill 86. And we also have a summary of change document that I can read after that, if that helps. So if you turn to the sectional analysis in Section 1, this section amends Alaska Statute 3630-300, the statute that relates to single-source procurements, to add a new subsection, F, that creates prohibits creation of contracts relating to the ownership or management of an inpatient mental health treatment hospital established under AS 4730-660C, which will be coming up in Section 4. That's where the real heart of the bill lies. So Sections 1 through 4 will be referring to this. Sections 1 through 3 will be referring to this section. Mm-hmm. Section 2 amends Alaska Statute 3630-310, the statute on emergency procurement, to add a new subsection B that would also prohibit the use of these statutes to create a contract relating to the ownership or management of an inpatient mental health treatment hospital established under AS 4730-660C. Section 3, this amends Statute 4730-660B to correspond with the new subsection in AS 4730-660C, established following. So like I said, Section 4 is where we establish the real heart of the bill. This amends AS 4730-660 to add a new subsection that requires the Department of Health and Social Services to maintain an inpatient mental health treatment hospital in the state of Alaska. It prohibits the state from delegating or from contracting for the ownership or management of this facility, and it also defines inpatient mental health treatment hospital for the purposes of this section. Section 5 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska to define the applicability of new subsections established in 1 through 4 to contracts entered into, amended, extended, or renewed after the effective date of this act. Section 6 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska to state if this act takes effect after February 1st, 2016. It is retroactive to, 2019. It is retroactive to February 1st, 2019. And then finally, Section 7 provides for an effective date under AS1.10.070C. It would take effect immediately. So if you flip over to the summary of changes for the committee substitute for House Bill 86, I can kind of just run over the reasons we made the changes in this committee substitute. Several changes were made between version M and the committee substitute, which is version U of House Bill 86. The administration had voiced concern that it would be unable to contract for various services that are currently handled by local vendors, such as maintenance, security, and laundry, and we respect and understand those needs. So the committee substitute sought to address those concerns by making the following changes. Section 1, we deleted the terminology operation and maintenance to allow the department to continue to use limited competition procurement statutes for certain aspects of the operation and maintenance of the hospital. Section 2, followed in the same vein, we deleted operation and maintenance to allow the department to continue to use the statute for emergency procurements for certain aspects of the operation and maintenance of the hospital. And Section 4, we deleted operate and maintain to allow the department to continue to contract out for certain aspects of the operation and maintenance of the hospital. This meant that Section 4C and version M was condensed into one section in the current version of the bill, version U. And finally, Section 6, this reflects the accurate retroactive date for Alaska Psychiatric Institute's contract with WellPath. Thank you.
All right, are there any questions regarding the changes explained? All right, seeing no questions, I'm going to remove my objection now to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS? All right, seeing none, the CS has been adopted. All right, I want to thank you very much for presenting to the committee today. I think we're going to take up this bill again in about another week time to allow us time to mull on this a little bit. And with that, I'm going to call the close of this committee.
One more question for the representative before he steps away.
Okay.
That's okay. I just want to make it sounded like in your presentation you indicated that you didn't have a problem with someone doing it, even potentially Providence, but I think to the point that we just highlighted, Section 4 pretty much would prevent that from ever happening. You spent a lot of time talking about WellPath and your concern with them. It is your intent, I just want to make clear, it's your intent that Providence or anyone else, that they should not be able to own or Section 4, own or manage the hospital. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's a good question. I would consider it a friendly amendment. I would be happy to work with the committee if the committee's desire is to limit management of API to either a state operator or a nonprofit operator, so that the department would retain the authority to go through a competitive procurement process for nonprofit management. I think that would address all the concerns I have with patient safety and worker safety, and that would allow Providence or other nonprofit providers potentially to partner to provide better services.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. So in wrap up, I just want to let everybody know that on Tuesday, we're going to be having a joint hearing of the House State Affairs Committee on the single source procurement for Alaska Psychiatric Institute. So we're going to have the opportunity to spend a lot of time talking about this process. We'll be hearing from the Department of Health and Social Services as well as the Department of Administration on the procurement process as a whole. On Thursday, we'll be hearing invited and public testimony on the following bills: HB 84 by Representative Josephson relating to workers' compensation, HB 89, which is the bill I've introduced regarding opioid prescription information, HB 92 by Representative Johnston dealing with direct care agreements for healthcare services, and HB 114 is another bill that I've introduced which would create a Sharp 3 loan payment program for medical providers. The time is 4:39, and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.